You're listening to Panel Borders on Resonance 104.4 FM. I'm Alex Fitch, and this is Resonance's weekly show about the world of comics. In this week's show, I'm concluding my look at the publishing history of Marvel Comics in the UK in the 1990s. This was a period when Marvel UK stopped being a licensee of popular kids' franchises such as Transformers and Thundercats, and became a creator of homegrown action-adventure titles such as Death's Head and Dragon Claws. And this show is the second half of a panel discussion I curated on the subject with a quartet of British creators, Gary Erskine, John Freeman, Simon Furman and Dan Abnett, who worked for Marvel UK in the 80s and 90s, recorded at the London Science Fiction Film Festival, Sci-Fi London, earlier this year. We're picking up the panel with a discussion of the Arthurian-themed comic, The Knights of Pendragon, featuring Captain Britain. And the first voice you'll hear after mine is Dan Abnett's. First, though, here's a word from our sponsors.
Resonance FM is London's only non-profit community radio art station, who need your donations to help keep the station and podcasts on air. All the program makers and all the engineers all work for free to bring you shows as diverse as The Bike Show, The Free University of the Airways, Hooting Yard, Speakers Resonance Corner, FM accepts donations in the form of cheques, credit and debit cards, radio, bank transfers, country, PayPal and cash. Go to www.resonancefm.com for more details. We also accept hobnobs and teabags. Your donation means our continued existence.
What was the genesis of Knights of Pendragon? Because the original Captain Britain series came to an end, and the creative team, Chris Claremont, who created Captain Britain, and Alan Davis, who was drawing it at the time, went to do the sequel Excalibur in America. So was this an attempt to do a rival British version that was truer to the character?
I co-wrote it with John Tomlinson, but Steve White, the editor, was very much part of that. Mm-hmm. He didn't script anything, but the three of us used to brainstorm creatively the ideas for it. And I think we were disappearing up our own fundaments in terms of being completely lost in wonderful ideas of British myth and wanting to get a bit of Excalibur in there. And by Excalibur, I mean the John Borman film. All sorts of ideas of the British woodland, and it was an ecological... There was a huge, strong green theme to it, which we thought was... We printed it on scandalous paper, so it was... all this kind of stuff. It was very sort of, you know, right on. And it was... we set this idea up about the sort of Arthurian archetypes coming back and having a relevance to a modern, polluted world. And then probably almost... In hindsight, went, gosh, this isn't terribly commercial. We love it, but it's not very commercial. And also, Marvel US probably isn't going to like it. So how can we connect it into the British half of Marvel Universe continuity? Mm. And obviously, Captain Britain makes perfect sense because he's already got that strong Arthurian connection.
Was it set in the near future then?
No, we were doing it... We're sort of meant to be doing it in parallel. It was meant to be happening at the same time. We didn't see any problem with that whatsoever. Spider-Man appears in six comics, and Wolverine is everywhere. I saw him in the shop outside. He's just... You know, so it didn't seem to be a problem to us.
Okay.
Even the fact that ours had a darker tone, we also didn't worry. And we also thought it was wonderful that we picked up on Di Thomas, the police guy, police inspector who'd been in the original story, and used him because it gave it to us a solidity and a consistency. So it did feel like a real world that was carrying on. So we blithely went on our merry way. And it was only after a while that we realised that they were slightly alarmed that we were using characters they felt were theirs, and slightly alarmed that we were doing really quite, as Gary said, shocking things with them. even though we knew that we were never going to cross a line and things would be explained and heroism would be, you know, when Captain Britain does that, he's not himself, and it's not what it appears to be. And there are themes of sacrifice and there's all primordial myths being retold.
Gary Erskine.
Long 28 days between issues.
We left them sweating, but the point is it was perfectly safe, and we weren't breaking the toys and giving them back something they weren't going to be able to deal with. But it was... We tried to put a real sort of realistic edge on it, a real realistic and mythological edge on it, which we felt that was something that had been there in the earlier Captain... in the classic, what I think of the classic Captain Britain stories, which in Excalibur's a great fun comic, but it was played very much more for fun and wildness, and you know, it was just a different tonal thing, and it clearly appealed to a British audience and drove American editors through the roof. It reminds me actually when they kept coming back after every six issues, they asked us to go through approval to see whether we could carry on doing it, and they would sort of come back and try and coax Tom DeFalco and the late Mark Grunewald, a lovely guy, used to come over to visit us regularly and sort of coach us about storytelling and encourage us to come up with concepts that could be marketed in the US and not these strange things with human sacrifice like Knights of Pendragon.
Yeah.
And I remember at one point Tom DeFalco, in all seriousness, I'm totally straight face, suggested that we should pick on a British archetype and make a comic out of that, and why didn't we do a comic called, I don't know, The Red Squirrel? And he couldn't understand why we found that funny.
John Freeman.
But later on, when Paul Meury sort of like started the Marvel books in 92, there was supposed to be a sort of like consultation with editors at Marvel US about the use of characters, even in cameo. And some editors at Marvel US were better than others at coming back and saying, yes, you can, or yes, no, you can't use characters. Mm. Like, for example, Bobby Chase was actually quite good at that sort of thing. Mm.
Well, Simon, one of your most popular characters is the bounty hunter Death's Head, who first appeared in Transformers. And that must be one of the weirdest sort of journeys of a character. He started off in Transformers, encounters Doctor Who in Doctor Who comic, shrinks him to human size using the Master's tissue compression ray. He then gets a title of his own, and then he turns up in Fantastic Four and She-Hulk in America. I mean, could you explain that process? Well, that's absolutely bonkers.
Simon Furman.
The genesis of the character was this. When we were coming up with a Transformers strip, we needed a generic bounty hunter character for that story. And it was only ever meant to be one story, and especially with something like Transformers, where you have a whole cast anyway, killed off or moved off and never used again. So we came up with just a name. I just had a name and a vague idea of a skull-type head, and it went off to the artist, who happened to be Jeff Senior. If it had been another artist, and this is no disrespect on another artist, it may have been a completely different story. But Jeff came back with such a wonderful visualisation of the character that I went back into the script and rewrote the character in terms of its dialogue. Mm. Gave him the quirks, gave him the yes and the a's and the sort of funny mannerisms, and the whole freelance peacekeeping thing, you know, was all added in afterwards, really. He was a much more generic badass bounty hunter character. So then it kind of gave us a problem, because we got this good character, but we didn't want him to become property of Hasbro, which would have been the case had he appeared successively in Transformers. Mm. So we very rapidly, while that issue was going into production, came up with a little one-page strip that a new artist called Brian Hitch drew.
And whatever happened to him.
Yes, I know, yeah. And so that was quickly rushed into production, slapped on the back of a few other titles.
Yeah, I think they ran it in Scan as well, because they literally tried to make it copyright to Marvel UK.
Completely, as quickly as possible, this thing was done there. I mean, you know, they're done in one little gag strip, but it copyrighted it Marvel, so that by the time, and this, you know, there may be a little grey area as to which actually hit the stands first, but we were busy copywriting it so that, you know, we could, if we wanted to, extract that character later. And this was all happening very, very fast, and I guess with some prescience that we had something special going on with the character. And then there was a, right, now let's get him out of Transformers. I mean, he served his purpose. He became almost more popular than the Transformers, which was worrying to Hasbro, and starting to, you know, when we're getting feedback that was like, oh, Death's had a great character, and it's like, maybe we need to move him out now. So the question was, how do we do that? And it was while we were just beginning to dabble with the American format, we'd come up with the idea for Dragon's teeth, which became claws, and then the idea was also to come up with a Death's Head comic. And the question then was, well, he's giant-sized, and we want him kind of Marvel superhero-sized. So how do we move him out? A, move him out of Transformers, and B, shrink him in size? The loops we had to go through. So the answer happened to be Doctor Who. And, you know, for no particular good reason except that, you know, it involved time and dimensional travel. And then, you know, then the question still was, how do we reduce him in size? And I, being a growing up with Doctor Who, remembered some gadget of the Masters. I didn't have the name for it. I couldn't remember what it looked like. But I seem to remember it shrunk things.
I mean, I hate to be the one to point this out, Simon, but it's called the tissue compression eliminates.
Yes.
And he's a robot.
Yeah. Oh, details.
That's why it didn't kill him.
Yes. But thankfully, you know, I mean, we got, I think Lee came up, Lee
designed
Sullivan.
It. He actually provided Jeff with designs of the sonic screwdriver to
the tissue decompression eliminator, And so, we did all this loop, moved him into Dragon's Claws for a quick kind of crossover, because we love the idea of a crossover.
Absolutely, boost sales.
And then straight into Death's Head's own title. So, and then after that, we started getting good vibe from American. We got a little letter of congratulations from Stan Lee, which I still have somewhere, saying how much he liked the character. And Walt Simonson, who was doing Thor at the time, really liked Death's Head. We'd met him and he said, what a great character, and I'm doing Fantastic Four, and can I use him in Fantastic Four? And we did a little trade-off. We said, well, do us a couple of covers. You can use him in Fantastic Four. Like, we wouldn't have let him anyway. But so he did both the cover to the Death's Head graphic novel, A Body in Question, and I think issue 9 or something of the series, the Fantastic Four cover. And then he took him over to Fantastic Four. And then when I crossed over and started doing work for Marvel US, of course, I was immediately looking for any place I could drop Death's Head in. And I was given some fill-ins on She-Hulk, so immediately he was in She-Hulk. And so it rolled on. So, yeah, we just got... And just recently, I don't know whether you're aware, but he cropped up in Sword.
Yeah, yes. In giant size.
In giant size, in his kind of original form. So.
And I think a one-panel cameo in Paul Cornell's Captain Britain and MIT.
Yeah. So, you know, the character just rolls on, you know, in a steady way. And, you know, we've done our Death Set. There was Death Set 2, of course. I did Death Set 3.0. So, you know, the character, strangely, has a kind of a low-key life of, you know, longevity and life of its own.
Yes, there's the second version.
Yep.
That's Liam, isn't it?
That's Liam. That's Simon Colby.
Well, then that brings us on to the second generation of Marvel UK titles, as it were. There's Death Set 2... and Kill Power and Motormouth.
Yes.
Could you talk a little about those titles?
Yeah, well, those, I mean, in part, I wasn't involved in the early gestation because, as I understand it, there was, Paul had originally talked to you about reviving Death's Head, and I probably haven't got enough time to go into detail, unfortunately, but suffice to say, there was a
Death's Head series happening.
You wrote one, didn't you?
Yeah, I'd written at least a couple of issues. Jeff was drawing the first issue, and then the change of direction came in and that series was canned. And, you know, I've got to say it was probably the right thing to do because it did move things on. But at the time I was distinctly unhappy about it. But, you know, those are the breaks. And yes, it was canned in full light. And I wish I still had some of it because the actual artwork was gorgeous. But I have no idea, and Jeff never keeps anything. So, it's kind of lost now, which is a real shame, yes. Yeah. But yeah, so, and then it became Death's Head 2.
I think, Death's Head, in as much as it was just keeping the name, I think, because the name was a sort of a hook that drew people's attention. Yeah. It was Liam Sharp who had come up with this visualisation of the character. And I think that was really essentially it. It was a great looking character who bore very little...
Virtually no resemblance
or had anything to do with it other than we could call it the same thing. And
it's got the horns.
It's got the horns, I suppose, yeah.
And a gun.
But it sort of became... I mean, they laced the original into it, didn't they?
Well, I was asked to come in and write it simply to try and make some sort of sense of what was going on with the bits that were left over from the redesign. And it was quite successful... I can't remember how many issues it ran for.
Well, the first Death's Head miniseries ran for four issues, and the first issue was reprinted, I think, at least twice, which is an absolute rarity in those days. But you have to don't forget that at the time, the Marvel UK were doing those US series books. The first ones, even Shadow Riders, which is a later one of the period, the first issue sold 144,000 copies in direct sale. And I think, you know, Death's Head was by far the best-selling title, and that's why every single title had the word frigging word death in it. You know, even after I was going, and if you talk to Bambos Giorgio, who was one of the editors at the time, he would tell you, he would despair that that was the reason why Marvel UK basically shot itself in the foot, because it diluted its entire concept. And Andy and Dan have very strong views on the whole thing, and rightfully so, but I wasn't there towards the end, so I don't know really what happened, other than that, very sadly, a lot of stuff got canned, including a beautiful Mark Harrison Death's Head painted series, which he has actually posted online if you go looking for it.
Yes.
It's absolutely wonderful if you can track it down. It's a beautiful story, and I'm surprised it's never been reprinted.
Mm. Or
never,
Panini's reprinting all this stuff.
Yeah, well, it wasn't finished, so it would require actually finishing the work.
There's not much left to do.
No, there's only about... It's the last book, isn't it?
Mm. It's the last... Yes, it's some of the last issue.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's a very small
We did discuss it at one time,
didn't
we?
Yeah.
And I think with that second wave, they kind of shot themselves in the foot as well with the amount of US guest stars they slapped into every issue.
Yeah, but again, that was forced on Paul Neary. That was the compromise for Paul to get his grand dream of Overkill, which was his comparison title for 2000 AD. He wanted to do 2000 AD in the UK. The marketing advice that we had for a while, the inference was that he didn't want superheroes in Overkill because he thought 2000 AD didn't have superheroes. As far as he was concerned, and then we had a marketing panel, which is always disastrous for any company. And we were sitting—I don't know if you were there—but we were standing behind this mirror, watching these teenagers looking at Overkill and 2000 AD, and they were looking at Marvel titles. Well, why are there no superheroes in it? Because they expected superheroes to be in a Marvel title, and it was at that point that all the superhero elements of the Marvel UK titles we were doing. Came into Overkill as well. Before that, the Marvel UK titles that were going out in the US were pure superhero. Overkill was all the pages that weren't superheroes. So effectively, the writers and the artists were creating stories that two stories in one in each issue.
Yeah.
And Paul Neary was the absolute driving force for better or worse. And he rubbed people up the wrong way. But he also got on with usually drove people and introduced a lot of incredible artists, like Gary Frank, Gary Frank, Power, all got their
and also artists like Salvador La Roca, Carlos Pacheco got their first English language work.
Yeah. Yeah. All came back. And eventually, Paul was brought around to say, look. You know, the people who were working solidly for Marvel UK for years and years and years are good artists. They'll deliver on time, which is more than the guys you found in San Diego were at that time.
One of the problems, and this is what I think Simon was referring to, is that we wanted to guest star, or there was a desire to guest star the American superheroes in these comics, because they would add to the sales in the States.
Yeah.
But because the American editors were really wary about what was going to be done with with Cable or Wolverine, we couldn't do much with them apart from they'd turn up, have a fight, and go away again. There was no substance to their appearances, so it eventually became sort of just vanilla storytelling.
Yeah.
And that is the death. Unfortunately, not in a nice sales way. But that is the
and the broad spectrum of this is that Marvel US saw Marvel UK as a sort of like a spillover for them to put more books on the shelves in the States. To compete with all the new independent comic companies that were starting up, like Image and things like that, the idea being that a direct sales shop would have the choice between a Marvel book, which they knew would be delivered on time because that was how Marvel made a success of itself, or try out an Image title, which they weren't sure it was a new company, would they actually deliver the second issue or not? And invariably, those direct sales shops would go for the Marvel titles, whether they had been produced in the UK or been produced in the US. And so those Marvel UK titles had to have American superheroes in them for those direct sales shops to buy them, which is, again, isn't creative in any way. It's you're driven by sales and the demands of the retailers rather than the wishes of the audience, i.e. you guys who turned up today who obviously had interest in Marvel UK.
Well, just in the wrong room, you know that, don't you?
I can sense a little bit of frustration from the editor's end of the room. But Gary, what was it like for you as an artist at the time? Because, I mean, you know, your work is particularly iconic from that period.
Well, that funnily enough, I was still in my date stamping phase, 26th of January 1990. Is that today?
Yeah.
What happened was, that was January. So in March or April, there was the Glasgow Comic Convention that this was done for. Paul Neary stood behind me as was, because I'd obviously had 2 years under my belt with Knights of Pendragon, and basically said, do you want to draw this stuff for real month after month? I said, hell yeah. What I had to do was distill just all these ideas from the previous convention sketch into, like, Misha's here, that's Leona, although I think her name was changed later, and distill it down to six identifiable characters. But basically, this was me, to be given the opportunity, you've got to understand, it was a very creative time, there was a lot of really fresh young talent, and people who were willing to back and invest in young talent, and to be told that you could draw comics and do almost whatever you wanted to do, it literally was a dream come true. Unfortunately, the reality of, I didn't know about all the other stuff that was going on at the time, but it didn't seem too bad to me to originally.
Oh, no,
have
I mean,
Wolverine
it was very fun
in.
To do. Yeah. Yeah. No, don't get me wrong. I mean, I wouldn't have missed it for the world. I mean, it was an incredible experience, certainly. I mean, but it was. I mean, at one time I was editing 12 books a month.
Yeah. You know, oh no, no, wasn't.
If you can
imagine drawing all this, knowing that there's maybe 10 captions and balloons,
yeah.
And then suddenly realizing there's 20 or 30, and all this gorgeous stuff is covered up, you would draw knowing that it was going to be dead space, but you'd still put in a building so that it would look nice. To actually see your finished artwork, and in the old days it was physically stuck on the artwork,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
To see about a third of the page disappear when you knew that there should only have been maybe a fifth of that page covered,
yeah.
that was... I was young, I was stupid, and I took it very personally, unfortunately.
Well, there was an occasion where on the second edition of Warheads, this is very sort of like a trivial story, but not for you, because Paul flopped a panel on one of your pages and you went absolutely ballistic with him. Well, ballistic with me, and I had to sort of like pretend it was me that did it rather than Paul.
Yeah, I kind of remember it. There was a lot going on personally.
Yeah.
Not really.
But yeah, you know, these things, sort of things, you know, I sort of acted as Paul's filter between the artist and sort of like tended to get it in their neck. But, you know, that's what you're there for as an editor. You don't
in context, my parents went through a divorce and I split up with my then girlfriend. So my head wasn't in a particularly good place. So flipping a panel.
It's
like, you know,
thank God you didn't work in manga.
Yeah, could have stormed the offices.
I have heard stories about people threatening to storm offices even now with samurai swords because they've done something wrong. So
I look back on Warheads as possibly the most creative time ever, and we had the little anecdote outside that people think I did a lot more. Like Faulty Towers, people think it ran and ran and ran. Mm-hmm. I think there's only...
two issues, you drew.
Maybe even less than two issues because there's a little backup issue.
True, yeah.
I maybe did 30 pages of Warheads, and out of a 20-year career, and then some, people always say, Warheads, those six issues you did. It's all this idea.
Yeah, I said it was at least that.
Yeah. I think it probably took people the length it would take to read six issues just to see all the crap that I used to put in. I think it just felt longer.
In a good way.
You should reprint it like a panel a page.
Yeah. Also, see if you go back, see it's strange seeing artwork this to the melee when they're fighting. You never expect your artwork to be seen this big. That's a nod of the hat to Simon Bisley, who used to do the ABC Wars, and he used to put profanity on the bars. And you always wanted to be the first person to put in the F word, or the first person to have some rude T-shirt design or mouth of an alien.
Did it get in? I can't remember.
I think that actually was edited out,
yeah.
Because that's a scan of the original artwork. There's some minor lettering missing where they go tag. They kind of touch the head and say tag. But yeah, it even when you were caught, there was just that sense of being able to do it in the first place. You had a good eye, I must admit. You were. I think you were aware. It's like, oh.
Some of the stories you hear about some of the early guys, not this isn't a Marvel UK story, but if you go online, there are websites which don't report this thing, where they used to do entire dummy pages and present them to editors as if they, you know, with horses with large testicles and things like that. This is Marvel UK, this is the old American comic books guys, and these people go bonkers, the editors go bonkers, and unfortunately, on occasion, some of these things nearly made it to print because the editor wouldn't notice.
Yes.
Well, actually, there was the pages of, if some of you have read Chris Weston and Grant Morrison's The Filth,
yeah.
Chris, as you know, if it's a T-54 tank, he will draw it down to every little nook and cranny. If it's a farmhouse, he will get all the brickwork, whatever. When it's a naked man with cowboy boots and a Stetson hat walking around taking videos of people and other debauched things, he will draw the full guy. And being the ever proficient inker, I will ink it. So that was issue 5. And then we were working on the next issue and I just said to Chris, it is going to be covered up, isn't it? I never really thought about it.
A
word balloon or a black ball. Surely someone somewhere... So we frantically called the editors, and in the end, they did a little pixelated square like you get over faces. And we breathed a hearty sigh of relief because the two of us just, they'll deal with it. But you never know if they're as eagle-eyed as you were in the Marvel days.
Yeah, you just knew what evil scamps would get up to. It was fantastic working with them, it really was. I mean, Marvel UK had a basement full of artists. and we wouldn't let them out until they finished books. So there were occasions where, you know, Liam was...
Some of them died.
Some of them died. They're bricked up in Arundel House. You can still hear the screams. But there were Liam Sharp, Edwin Bagwell, who's now gone back to being called Evan Bagwell. Rodney Ramos managed to come over from America, and we trapped him in there as well. Liam Sharp, Brian Hitch was down, moved down from Carlisle. It was his first experience of London, and I think he was permanently drunk for most of it, wasn't he? And Paul Neary was, I have to say, was pretty much in the pub generally on most days. You know.
But when you think now, like 20 years later, we throw around the name Brian Hitch with the Ultimates and everything that he's done, and I can remember being at one of the London conventions and he beat me at pool. And it was just it was also casual, and we were just doing it for the love of it.
Yeah.
Dermot Power is Star Wars development work, the movies, that is.
Well, that was a point I was going to make, you know, that everyone talks about 2000 AD as the place where all these writers and artists started. Well, Marvel UK, you know, Pat Mills, David Lloyd, Alan Moore all worked on Doctor Who magazine, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, I mean, well, you know, Grant Morrison did his Zoids. First work on Zoids.
Yeah.
I think yes, it was a great sort of starting place for so many things. I mean, it achieved a lot, but it achieved a lot for a lot of people as well, individually in terms of careers and developing talents. And I think it also, I think as a physical place where people went and worked together rather than as an office where artwork was sent and distributed, it was the closest that's ever come to like Marvel in New York. It was a proper comics office where people were coming in, they were working in a bullpen, there was a sense of creativity, people moving from office to office and developing ideas and not being selfish about them, but just saying, oh, look at that, here's a good idea. It was there was a real sense of vitality
and a sense of madness as well. I remember running fights with big water pistol guns around the Marvel UK offices with artwork lying around and things like that, and you think it really wasn't wise, but yes, good times.
I think they're probably going to chuck us out any minute now, but if anyone has any questions for the panel,
speak now,
forever hold your peace.
Can I just ask if this Manson Pendragon is out in the shop yet? I don't think it's going to be published, I've never seen it.
I literally did the cover. I presume so. I did the cover, like... last year, I was getting chased, so I thought it was already out.
I understood it was meant to be out just before Christmas.
Yeah,
and for whatever reason, it has been delayed, and I haven't been told.
Panini do tend to delay their trade paperbacks quite regularly, though, don't they? Because the Death's Head 3 was mooted to come out. Did it ever come out?
There's two Death's Head collected editions, and that's it.
It's more than just somebody saying, "Oh, they might do it," because I was shown the flat scans and everything. It's all ready to be published. It just hasn't actually arrived yet. In fact,
is there backup material in it as well? Is there a sort of story telling the story behind it and that sort of thing?
Well, if there is, it's not from me.
Right. Richard Starkings.
Can I just add the as far as you talk about the community aspect and the Marvel US sort of bullpen environment with creative people, it shows you that, I mean, I did 2 years from 89 to about 92 with Knights of Pendragon, then Warheads, and then there was Tundra and Marvel US and a lot of other things. John just got in touch with me out of the blue last year and said, you know, they're recollecting Knights of Pendragon, get in touch with the guy, maybe if you've got, like, you said, like, old artwork, whatever. I got in touch with the editor, Brady Webb, and said, look, any chance I can do a cover? Because this is so important to defining me as an artist and setting me, as much as I think Warheads was my creative sort of mark, there was so much good came out of Knights of Pendragon, the characters and the stories and what have you, that to have any input and push for a cover, they allowed me to do this, which I'm so pleased with, using our characters who were never in spandex. That was another thing that the US tried to enforce. And we kept Kate and Ben very much, and Di Thomas, very much grounded. But that, again, just from John saying, why didn't you get in touch with this editor? I get a cover out of it on something that is so important to me. And I think that connection's still there after 20-odd years. And
yeah, the comic mason still works.
Yeah, there is still very much, for all the big sales and the companies, there's still very much a village feel to it. You know, we all know
Steve's,
each other.
Steve's doing a bit for me for Charlie's Walker, actually, that I'm working on at the moment. So, you know, it's also... If I could find something to get you guys to do, I would be doing it.
Well, I mean, there is a fear on the internet at the moment that these collections that Panini are bringing out at the moment of, hopefully, Knights of Pendragon any day now, and Captain Britain and Dragon's Claws and so on, their days are numbered because people are worried that Disney will come in and say, we're taking the rights away from you, and so on and so forth.
I don't know. It'll depend. No, the license for Panini isn't due for renewal until 2012. So, okay, I think it will, unless Panini do something, then they say that you've done something really bad, so we're going to take it away from you. They are, Panini and Disney are mortal enemies in certain countries. Like they hate each other in Italy, for example. But it's down to, you know, Panini's got a successful license. They built all the brands up in the UK. There are still pocket editions of Marvel reprints in the UK which sell pretty well.
The foreign editions are pretty
good. Yeah, I mean,
too.
Scott Gray's doing a good job. I think it's CC Edits, isn't he? And they'll do it till 2012, and then they'll look at the license again, and that'll be when maybe Disney will look in and say, well, no, we're taking over. And again, this goes back to what I was saying earlier about people buying the licenses from, or taking over the licenses from a company. You don't want to be reliant on licensed characters ever, because you know they can so easily be taken away from you. And you need your Death's Edge, you need your Knights of Pendragon, you need your Captain Britons, and long may they continue.
Yeah,
I think that's very good summing up.
Absolutely,
the panel.
Thought it might be.
So I'd like to thank John, Dan, Simon, and Gary, and all of you for coming.
Thank you.
In next week's show, we're continuing our look at British creators of American-style superheroes with a look at some of the most famous titles created by Brits, published by DC Comics. In the meantime, you can hear previous episodes of this show, including episodes looking specifically at Captain Britain via interviews with Chris Claremont, Alan Davis and Paul Cornell, on our blog at www.panelborders.com. Thanks for listening.